Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today is a cartoonist, illustrator, editor, and political pundit, best known for the 1990s comic book Hate. He also edited the Weirdo comics anthologies back in the 80s and went on to author a series of illustrated biographies, including Rebel Woman, Fire, and Credo. Peter Bagg, it's a real pleasure to have you back in the studio.
Oh, well, thanks a lot. Great to be here.
You have been pretty busy lately, working with DC Comics on a couple of projects and drawn on Quarterly on some graphic biographies, but a lot of comics readers still remember you as the creator of Buddy Bradley, the star of Hate and Neat Stuff comics back in the 1990s.
That's right, back from the former century. But yeah, it probably is what I'm still best known for.
And you've actually continued to follow the adventures of Buddy Bradley and his circle. You've taken him from a sullen teenaged pot dealer in New Jersey to a Seattle grunge impresario, and then back east where he became something of a working class icon.
Yeah, all through the 90s, I spent almost all my time working on Hate Comics, which was stories about Buddy Bradley. And then towards the end of the decade, I was getting all these opportunities that were too good not to take advantage of. And I never wanted to just work on one character for my whole life. So ever since then, I've been doing all kinds of things, all different things. But I still wanted to keep that Buddy Bradley character alive. So at least all through the aughts, every year I would put out a Hate annual, which would have like a short Buddy Bradley story. I just wanted to keep his heart pumping, so to speak. And I still had a lot of story ideas for him, but the readers didn't see. I made him older. Now he's married. He has a kid. He's pursuing very uncool, unromantic professions like scrap metal collecting and dealing. So not surprisingly, a lot of the former Hate readers lost interest. Sales kept going down. So I was like, all right, enough. If nobody's going to buy this thing, I'm not going to keep doing it. Although I still had plenty of ideas for him. And people still will. It seems like a reflective or a reactionary question, like something just to ask me. I don't know if they're serious or not, but I'm frequently asked if I'm going to revive Buddy Bradley. And the answer is, I don't know. Maybe one day, but there's not much reason. There's certainly no economic reason to revive them.
Well, yeah, I mean, all of the Gen X readers nowadays, you know, they're happy to look back on their misspent youth, maybe in the Pacific Northwest, but it's kind of hard to look at the realities of raising a family and doing a day-to-day job nowadays, I suppose.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, the demographic that buys alternative comics, they tend to be in their 20s, you know, I'd say like between 18 and early 30s. And once you reach that point that you have a spouse and children and a mortgage and you become much more career focused, going to the local alternative comic shop really becomes a very low priority. And meanwhile, if you do comics that reflect your own life, you know, being I'm 61 now, doing comics that reflect the life I'm living now and my own experiences, that simply doesn't interest that core comic buying audience, 20-somethings. They don't want to read about their dad or their grad dad even.
You kind of moved out. You live in Tacoma now, but you moved out to Seattle at the beginning of kind of the Northwest comics boom and when Fantagraphics was still a struggling publisher. And you really kind of set the tone along with folks like Charles Burns. What was it like to be considered the grunge artist back in the 90s?
Well, yeah, I moved to Seattle in 1984. And there were just a few cartoonists living in Seattle, and they barely hung out with each other. My wife loves to host parties, and so we would force all these people to socialize. See, maybe Portland was the same way back then, or still is, but it was like a city of hermits. People really kept to themselves. There wasn't,
introverts, huh?
Yes, there wasn't really much of a scene. When we'd say, let's all get together, their response was usually, why? but Seattle then, just like Portland, it was a great place for an artist to move. If you did something where it didn't matter which city you were living in, why not Seattle? It used to be cheap back then, amazingly. So it wasn't surprising that more and more artists and writers and cartoonists and musicians started moving in. And then a handful of them, especially musicians, suddenly became superstars, which brought a lot more attention to Seattle. But as far as you were also asking me, like, you mentioned, like, Charles Burns, who grew up in Seattle, but he moved away from Seattle a very long time ago, before I moved there. All the cartoonists that I felt a kinship with, you know, my peers, so to speak, like the Hernandez brothers and Dan Clowes, and all those Canadian cartoonists like Chester Brown and Seth, we all felt a kinship, but we all lived so far away. We would only see each other at the most once a year at a comic convention or two, or if somebody was visiting your town. So it always was a very disparate community. It was always we were always very far apart. It was mainly just writing or talking to each other on the phone is how we stayed close. And now we don't even bother to do that. I hardly ever see or hear from these people that, you know, I still consider my peers.
Yeah, you recently teamed up with Gilbert Hernandez from Love and Rockets. The two of you have been doing a rock and roll themed comic for DC called Yeah.
Right, that was quite a while ago. That was 20 years ago when we did that. And yeah, that was at a time when both Marvel and DC, they were not doing well. These superhero movies, these CGI movies, they hadn't hit the screens yet. And they wound up making the companies a ton of money off of their main, most famous characters. But back then, both companies were really struggling, and so they were willing to give someone like me a chance to pretty much indulge myself. For whatever reason, I just decided to do something that was as different from Hate as possible. So it was short-lived, but for about a year, I wrote an all-ages comic called Yeah, which is basically practically a ripoff of Josie and the Pussycats. It was just about a three-girl rock band. And my daughter was like 9 at the time. I was totally indulging her. She always hated all my other comics. And she just said, why don't you do a comic that a little girl would want to read? So I was like, okay, Gauntlet Throne. And Gilbert Hernandez drew it. But it only lasted 9 issues. And then a while after that, I did another short-lived humor comic for DC called Sweatshop, which was basically an excuse to satirize the entire cartooning industry, not just comic books, but also daily strips and all of that. And that unfortunately was also short-lived. I was really enjoying doing that one and had a lot of ideas for it. And I was told it was selling pretty good too, but they just kind of... it was just a knee-jerk cancellation. They figured it was... They just assumed right from the get-go that it was going to do bad.
Well, it was... Yeah, they really kind of gave you free rein on that one. Sweatshop was a satire about the dying days of the newspaper comic strip.
Right.
And its main character was this right-wing hack who relied on a stable of assistants. A number of readers thought the character might have been based on BC's Johnny Hart or Garfield's Jim Davis.
Yes, Jim Davis mostly, mainly because there was one person in particular that used to work for Jim Davis's studio, and he told me a lot of stories that really cracked me up. And how the whole idea of Sweatshop came about was I just met for lunch one day with the person who was my editor at DC. And we were just, he just wanted me to pitch ideas to him for a regular humorous series. But while we were sitting there at lunch, we both kept telling each other humorous stories about cranky old cartoonists. You know? And, you know, agreeing that cranky old men are always funny. So we just, and the hackier the artist's art was, the better. And then finally I was just like, why don't we just do that? Why don't we just do a comic book about a cranky, obnoxious old cartoonist.
Turning out catchphrases and coffee mugs. And,
right.
And you brought in some assistants of your own, some heavy hitters like Bill Ray, Stephanie Gladden, Stephen DeStefano, Jim Blanchard.
Sure. And Johnny Ryan. The reason for that, quite simply, was because DC, both as with Yeah and with Sweatshop, they wanted the comic to be monthly, had to be monthly. And I can't draw that fast. I can't fill up all by myself. I can't fill up a whole comic book once a month. Like when I was devoting all of my time to Hate comics in the 90s, It was tough to get it out four times a year, let alone, or even sometimes three times a year. So I had no choice but to collaborate with some people, although I totally enjoyed collaborating with all the people that you mentioned. I thought they all did a great job.
So do you have an insider story of the newspaper comics industry that you feel comfortable telling?
I've never done any kind of work for the syndicated newspaper strips. Something I wanted to do when I was little, but then as I got older, I became disenchanted with what was appearing in the daily strips. I suddenly realized that format is rather suffocating, especially when I discovered underground comics. And I was like, oh, here you could do as many pages as you want, write about whatever you want. Why restrict yourself to these little boxes in the newspaper? But I did at one point. I actually did have a conversation with somebody who is now deceased, but he was my age, a guy named Jay Kennedy, and he worked for King Features Syndicates. So he was kind of in charge of the syndicated comic strips they were putting out. And we actually did talk at one time about doing a syndicated Bradley Family strip. But it was too much. There was too many things that... It was too big an adjustment. First of all, the work, getting out a daily strip, that's an awful lot of work. And, all the things that I couldn't say, all the things I couldn't write about. Because when I was working with the Bradley families and with Buddy Bradley, I just wrote and drew whatever I felt like. There was no censorship at all. So that was this. And also, I always aged Buddy Bradley. I was always aging him in real time. And I don't think that would have worked in a daily strip. I can only think offhand. There's a couple of them. For better or worse, the characters got older as it went along. And so did this old comic strip, Gasoline Alley. The characters always aged in real time in those two strips. But for the most part, that's really rarely done.
Well, I was thinking of stories that inspired some of the storylines in Sweatshop, if you have one from your friend who worked for Jim Davis, for example.
Well, he was the one that... I hope I'm not getting him in trouble. He was the one that told me that Jim Davis, he said when you'd go to work, ever since that catchphrase, I hate Mondays, became a thing, and it was on coffee cups and T-shirts, and it was such a big thing, he kept trying to get lightning in a bottle again. He constantly was, when you trip for work, you go, how about this for a catchphrase, you know, I'm okay with Tuesdays. Just always trying to, at least this guy thought they were all terrible, but he was obsessed with, that's what he told me anyway. And so, yeah, I incorporated that story into the strip.
Well, you're mentioning underground comics. Before you moved to Seattle, when you were a student at School of Visual Arts and hanging out in New York, you actually did a lot of underground publishing yourself with friends and associates in punk magazines, in low circulation fanzines.
Right. Yeah, the first thing I had a hand in self-publishing, it was a comic tabloid called Comical Funnies. And I did that with people who used, prior to that, was doing Punk Magazine, which went out of business. So they had some experience, and it was interesting. He had, at least with the first issue, we put out three issues, but with the first issue, because of punk, he had connection with New York-based distributors. So when that first issue came out, I actually saw it everywhere. It was like, I remember there was a pile of 50 of them at a newsstand in Penn Station. And I worked at a bookstore in Penn Station, so I walked past this newsstand, and I didn't even bring it there. I just saw this huge, gigantic pile of Comical Funnies. Like I said, it had to have been 50 of them. And then when my work shift was done and I went home, every single one of them sold. So I was like, boy, if everybody would just carry this thing, I guess we would have done pretty well.
Hook was in your mouth, man.
Yes. But, you know, but then each issue after that, it seemed like it kept selling worse, so... it was interesting, around the same time in England, a very similar, aesthetically similar publication called Viz started. I don't know if you've ever seen Viz.
Newcastle upon Tyne.
Right. Very crude, cartoony artwork and humor. And they started the same time we started Neat Stuff, and they just took off. They did fantastic. And I was like, what are we doing wrong? Why can't we be everywhere, be a phenomenon like those guys are? But it didn't happen.
Well, one thing that came of your publishing history with zines like Punk Magazine is that Robert Crumb, the legendary Robert Crumb, handed you the keys to Weirdo Magazine
Kingdom, yes.
back in the 80s, right. late 80s. And the two of you hadn't even met face-to-face at the time. Yeah. The story that I've heard is that you sent him some of your work from the New York punk zines and
other
things.
Yeah, we used to send him the magazines when Weirdo came out.
And he considered you the least neurotic artist that he knew of.
Something like, yeah, that's what he told. I didn't understand because I wasn't very experienced, and we had never met, but just from our communications, he just decided that I seemed fairly reasonable. Reliable, I guess, is what he was looking for. So, yeah, so I was the managing editor of Weirdo Magazine, which, for listeners who don't know, it was like an underground comics anthology that lasted all through the 1980s.
Some amazing people in there.
Yes, and there is I have to plug it, Last Gasp, who was the publisher of Weirdo, they put out this 300-page book all about Weirdo Magazine. The author, John B. Cook, he tried to track down every single person that ever contributed anything to Weirdo Magazine. And it's a fascinating book. Yeah, so it's called The Book of Weirdo. So if you're interested in that very bizarre time period, it's definitely worth looking at.
Yeah, that was kind of in this strange little trough between the underground comics of the 60s and 70s and then the later alternative comics of the 90s and aughts.
Right. It was a very strange time because it was the 1980s and Ronald Reagan was elected president twice. It was a bit of a backlash from the me decade of the 70s, so to speak. I'm speaking in very general terms and I'm using all these generalizations that lots of sociologists use and overuse. But what I do recall, as someone who wanted to do underground comics and as someone who was into at least what at the time was more underground music, by the late 70s I was into punk and new wave music, which the average American was not into. It wasn't massively popular at all. There suddenly became this really big divide. Compared to the 70s, there was a big divide between mainstream culture and underground culture. And everything, almost everything that I was interested in and that most of my friends and colleagues and peers were interested in, both making and consuming, was really shunted off into these far corners. And that would include something like Weirdo Magazine. It was hard to find. And if I'd go into like what used to be mainstream bookstores, Barnes & Noble's, Borders, places like that, I couldn't find anything that I wanted to read. I'd have to go, it usually would be like in a college town or some downtown part of a major city where you could find a bookstore or a comic shop that sold all this weird stuff. And it was very frustrating as a cartoonist. I was trying to develop my career all through the 80s. I hardly made any money. You know, I don't think it was until 1989 that I made a five-figure income off of my comics. So it was a real struggle. And I really used to think, this is useless. This is going nowhere. And it used to be prosecuted. Comic shops, bookstores, even cartoonists, they used to, comic shop clerks, they were always getting arrested. There really was this active suppression, this censorship going on at the time. The above ground and the underground all collided by the early 90s. And the grunge phenomenon, Nirvana, that did have a lot to do with it. That made people living in the suburbs, especially, you know, teenagers and college kids, that made them wonder, where the heck did this come from? And made them interested in punk, like an old school punk, you know. It suddenly was like a lot of people who never would have paid attention, because, mainly because they were unaware, they wanted to know where all of this came from. So then alternative comics exploded. None of us ever got rich, except for Matt Groening. But we all suddenly were making a living doing our comics. Not, I shouldn't say all of us, but a lot of us suddenly were, which seemed like that was unthinkable at a certain point before then. The only reason I stuck with it all through the 80s is I didn't know how to do anything else, you know? And my wife, to her credit, she just kept telling me, stick with it. Don't worry about it. Just stick with it. I want to read what you're going to draw, so just keep doing it. And then also, right at the same time my career took off, our first child was born. And the plan was, since my wife had her business and her business was doing well, the plan was that I would be the primary caregiver. I'd be a stay-at-home dad and then do comics when I could. So that when Hate Comics started, all day long I was taking care of an infant until my wife got home. And I had to draw all those comics at night. And then all of a sudden they were selling well. So both me and my wife were like, well, now what do we do? We're both making a decent amount of money. But then by that time, but partly because we had a kid, my wife was eager to sell her business. So, and then I was able to devote myself full time to the comics.
So you came in sort of at the bottom of the roller coaster in the 80s of underground alternative comics. And
right.
Just through sheer persistence, you rode the wave in the 90s. At the same time in the 80s that you were in New York, Art Spiegelman was coming out with the anthology Raw.
Right.
And I don't know if you ever crossed paths, but I've heard Spiegelman say that he's lost so many comics artists to rock and roll. And and you, like a lot of comics artists, are also a musician. You've sat in on a couple of different bands. We started the show with one of your songs, anyway.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, to go back to the 80s and Spiegelman, that was when I was living in New York in the late 70s and early 80s. Of course, that was a boom time for music with the aforementioned punk rock and new wave scenes, but very few of the cartoonists I knew dabbled in music. I can't even think offhand if any, and I wasn't either. When I was in high school, I was in a band when I was like in ninth grade, but it was kind of unthinkable living in New York City. You know, I was a drummer. Where the heck am I going to keep my drums and play them? But yeah, I did know Spiegelman fairly well. I used to visit him. I showed him my work. You know, I submitted my work to get into Raw because Raw started a tiny bit before Weirdo did. But he rejected it, and I wasn't surprised. I knew he would. For one, aesthetically, it didn't fit in. And also, I didn't know what I was doing still. What I showed him was really crude, and I knew it. But he, I maintained a civil relationship with him, and he was a great source of information. I used to use maybe showing him my latest work as a ruse just to talk to him, and I'd always ask him questions, like comic business related questions, because to me he was like the answer man. He knew everything that I wanted to know. And but anyhow, as far as music goes, it wasn't until mid-late 90s that I joined a band again. And it was actually all these young cartoonists and or employees of Fantagraphics that formed a total goofball band. And they didn't have a drummer, so I drummed for them. That was called the Action Suits. So I drummed for them off and on for a bit. And then I had another band for 10 years that pretty much dissipated recently, but mainly because I moved to Tacoma. But that band was called Can You Imagine? And but that band I was much more invested in. I played guitar in that one.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and my guest today is illustrator, editor, and comics artist Peter Bagg. One of my actual favorite comics of yours was drawn for the late lamented supermarket tabloid, The Weekly World News.
Right.
Yeah, Bat Boy was a huge hit. It inspired a stage musical, among other things.
Right. And I didn't create Bat Boy. I'm wondering how many of your listening audience even remembers The Weekly World News.
I loved it.
Yeah. Ever since it disappeared, people who've grown up without it have no idea what I'm talking about. But yeah, it was a tabloid supermarket newspaper, fake newspaper, and lots of headlines about aliens. You know, and half the people who bought it knew it was a joke, satire really. The other half took it all seriously. They really believed in it. But the paper was doing bad thanks to the internet. They were losing readership. And so while they were dying, an editor just asked me if I would do a comic strip about a character that they had already created called Bat Boy, a boy who's half bat and lives in a cave and does all the, but who also is like a superhero. So I did that for 2 years, and that was fun. That was a blast to do just because I could pretty much do whatever I wanted. And I liked the way the art came out. That was like something that particular strip, when I'd look at the art, I was very pleased with it. I don't know why the art clicked with that, but it did.
And another time when you've worn your editor hat, you've been a cartoonist and contributing editor for Reason magazine, the Libertarian magazine, for almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that time, libertarianism has kind of changed. Do you see a divide between kind of the 20th century libertarianism of Russell Means and Frank Zappa and modern 21st century libertarianism?
Well, the principle of it is still roughly the same. I just, again, I'm sneaking in a plug. I have a brand new biography out called Credo, and
right.
It's about an author named Rose Wilder Lane, who's best known as the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder, and she when she was young she was a socialist, but she started to change her mind about her political beliefs after going to Eastern Europe and seeing the beginnings of the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc, and just seeing how they would how they governed, and it made her reevaluate how she looked upon everything. Personally, she was an anarchist. She was against government, period. But she also knew that that wouldn't work. Like, humanity wasn't ready for pure anarchy yet. So she and other people who she was peers with, they would write these polemics that pretty much defined what became known as modern American libertarianism, the limited government, and the reasons for limited government, and why not to put so much blind faith and trust in government, and especially the federal government. And it isn't, this is the biggest problem that I have with people who have like a negative impression of libertarianism, where they just feel like, well, if you're against this, that, and the other government program, like if you're critical of or think we should get rid of the Department of Education, that means you're against education. And that's not at all the truth. It's not, it has nothing to do with not caring. It's just there are other ways to tackle these problems. There are other ways to approach and solve these problems. It doesn't always have to be the federal government creating a new bureaucracy or throwing even more money at this problem. And then miraculously, actually not miraculously, the problem still persists. It just becomes a much more expensive problem. So it's just all about, especially if people could do it on their own, having more faith in your fellow humans to solve their problems or solve their community problems, rather than have the government step in, have Big Brother step in and treat everybody like all these adults, like infants, you know, for doing things that somebody decided they shouldn't be allowed to do, and that also extends to, you know, the mass incarceration, which is something that I write a lot about. With reason, just criminalizing everything, especially so-called victimless crimes, drugs, prostitution. I have a major. I think all of those things should be legal. I believe in open borders. The idea that somebody is an illegal human just because of what piece of land they're standing on the planet Earth. You can stand on this plot of land, but you can't stand on this better plot of land, where you can get a better job. Like when somebody says, some Mexicans, they seem to refuse to learn to speak English and become full Americans. It's like, well, if that's the case, I guess that means that I don't have to fully embrace their culture and learn Spanish if I don't feel like it, you know?
Well, that's why I'm thinking that you and Rose Wilder Lane are more in that camp of old school libertarianism, where there was this similarity to anarchism. I mean, I mentioned Frank Zappa and Russell Means. They were interested in legalizing victimless crimes,
right.
Prostitution, pot smoking. Yeah, nowadays, libertarian tech bros seem more interested, in the words of playwright Jeff Dorchin, in turning the world into a desert slave planet. I mean, you look at Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, he seems unclear on the distinction between machines and human workers.
I've never heard, you're saying that there are people who advocate?
Well, you know, like the Paul Ryan types, they call themselves libertarians. They call themselves libertarians.
He sure didn't govern as one, though.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people would say, you know, well, especially the phrase that drives me crazy is when somebody says, I'm a libertarian, but, and then the words that come after but prove that the person who said that is not a libertarian at all. Paul Ryan, you know, like a lot of people, he read Ayn Rand and felt inspired by it. Her books might have inspired him to go into politics. But once he was in office, and this happens a lot, sadly, once he was in office, he did not govern as a libertarian at all. At all. There was nothing remotely libertarian about the way he governed, you know?
And the tech bros also don't want to be taxed at all. But let's face it, the internet was created over decades of enormous government investment.
Well, I don't know how much is enormous, but for people doing to tax people who are, for example, doing business over the internet, who exactly is going to do the taxing? You know, that's a real mess. And then with taxes, then you have to ask a bigger question: is where are these taxes going? More people than ever across the board. It doesn't matter what their ideology is, or most likely they don't have one. More people than ever are not paying their income tax. Everybody's ignoring the IRS, mainly because of the lack of trust in the IRS and all this crazy bullshit that our government is spending money on. These wars that don't end. How can you blame anybody if you're not paying taxes when we have all these wars that never ever end, and droning these countries that were not even officially at war with, and ICE. We're doing so many things. It's not like we're becoming a police state. We are a police state. Have you gone to a Major League Baseball game? To get into a comic convention I went to in Seattle, I had to go through all that security theater. It's like it took me forever just to get into the place. And yeah, and it's all a joke. A dog stuck its nose in my box full of comics, you know, and held it there for the longest time because I had a sandwich in there, you know. And the guard, the canine handler, he didn't do anything. I thought for sure he was going to say, oh, he must have found a bomb. But no, he found a sandwich. But the guard didn't even care what the dog found. I assume he just looked at me and he saw this old short-haired white guy. Yeah, he's no trouble. That's something, too, that... Like, I remember specifically, it was one of the first assignments I went to. It wasn't even for reason, but I covered the Democratic presidential election in 2000. And that's where they nominated Al Gore. You know, of course, it was a foregone conclusion. That convention was nuts because the people running the DNC, they were trying so hard to come across, not even a centrist, but kind of right wing, that they nominated as vice president Lieberman. Do you remember him? Yeah, he was extremely conservative. And every single speech, obviously this was something that they agreed of beforehand. Every single speech, they talked about God. They kept talking about God and family. That was a really big aside. And now I'm going back to my other aside. When I started covering political events, especially for reason, and there was another weird online publication before that called suck.com, which everybody must have thought was a porn site, even though it wasn't. Even if I forget, like, my badge, my lanyard, I was able to go pretty much wherever I wanted to go, and I could tell very quickly it was because I was a middle-aged, short-haired, nicely dressed white guy. You know, and there were these journalists who were more credentialed, probably better, smarter, more talented than me as a journalist. But it'd be a guy wearing torn jeans and there'd be a pot leaf on his shirt and he'd have dreadlocks and a backpack that could have anything in it. I wasn't walking around with a stuffed backpack. And these journalists, even if they were fully credentialed, they were always getting pulled aside and they'd be going, oh, man, oh, man. And of course, I believe that people should dress and look any way that they want. But I'm like, I kept wanting to say to that guy, if this is what you want to do, if you want to cover like the Democratic Party's convention and you want quick and easy, no hassle access to everything, just, you know, for now, why don't you get a haircut? I'm going wherever the hell I want to go.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier, for the past few years, you've been doing a lot of cartoons about being a dad. And one of the most notorious was a short piece called Let's Give Fascism a Chance. Right. So what were you thinking?
The title, of course, was a total, I was being totally sarcastic, but it was, and it's something that it's something that I was much more aware of with young mothers, how like, but I felt it, you know, being the father of a toddler and being new to parenthood. Your gut reaction to bad behavior when you're out in public is far less tolerant, you know, because you have this defenseless child to protect. So when you see a bunch of skateboarding kids acting like jerks, normally I would barely give them the time of day. I don't care what they're doing or saying. But when you have this one-year-old in tow, there is this part of you, this reptile part of your brain where it's like, skateboards should be banned. You know? And I know so many women who are even, at that time, a lot of young moms. It's like I was making fun of myself. I was just simply acknowledging this overprotective instinct, which I also know leads to bad laws, that unwillingness to take risks, not to want to risk anything, and just want to live in a bubble and not to have anybody impede on your life. And this obsession with safety, which has only gotten worse. That was the type of soft fascism that I was making fun of. But I was the point of the strip was that I feel that. I know what you're talking about. But a lot of, especially women I knew, they were like, no, I'm not going to apologize for it. They go, yeah, I used to be super duper liberal in the real sense of the world. I was very live and live, very, very tolerant. And now that I'm a mom, I'm not tolerant anymore. I can't stand this crap. You know, I want everything to be all safe and lovely and perfect, mainly for my young child. And if anybody betrays all these laws that I want enacted, they should go straight to prison. And I don't care what happens to them. I want my child to experience nothing negative. And that's an impulse. Well, it's a human impulse, but it's something that when translated into law has gotten worse and worse.
So you were being self-aware.
Yes, totally self-aware.
Do you think the country is suffering from an irony deficiency right now? Notably right now, there's renewed criticism of Robert Crumb for early absurdist comic stories like When the Goddamn Jews Take Over America. And considering that Crumb's wife, daughter, and grandson are all Jewish, it's probably safe to say that titles shouldn't be taken at face value.
Right, right. Well, a problem with that particular strip. And this strip was inspired by these extreme right-wing tracts that somebody sent him, something that the Aryan Nations and similar organizations, somebody sent to him, or he came across it and was just reading this extreme ideology. And he just simply, because it was so powerful and so profound, even though he didn't agree with it, he just felt this compulsion to do a comic about it. But Crumb always wrote and drew about things that were problematic, mainly him and his own instincts. And he would probably, if he asked him, he'd probably say, part of the reason I did it too is, like almost every human being that ever lived, would have these moments of knee-jerk anti-Semitic thoughts. You know, he himself would have these goddamn Jew thoughts. And being married to a Jewish woman doesn't necessarily change that. Even Jewish people can have these thoughts. And again, he's fully self-aware. But clearly when he did that strip, it's like there was something that touched him and made him self-conscious. And something that he's done all through his artistic career is to tap into that, tap into what's inside you that's not appropriate, that inappropriate behavior. And he gets in trouble when he wallows in it, like he did with something like that. His one regret about doing that particular strip was that the people that he was, in a part, satirizing, making fun of, the people who inspired that, they loved that strip. You know, they loved that. And so they reprinted it. And so when they would share it with people, people took it literally. Whereas if you were familiar with Crumb, you would had to know that this was just him being a punk. And so that recent criticism that you were talking about with Crumb, that the racism and sexism, he is talking about himself and his struggles with most, like throughout his career, mainly with women. And it all stems from, here I am playing psychiatrist, you know, from, as so many of us, it all stems from the effect that his burgeoning sexuality had, when he was going through puberty, teenager, before he got famous, basically. He was somebody that had a very powerful libido, but he also was trapped in this geeky, funny, awkward, kind of ugly body, the type of body and personality that women in and of itself, they do not find attractive. So he was very frustrated and very resentful. Resentful towards women, resentful towards men that did have an easy
alpha
time.
Alpha males.
Yes. So like somebody said, it's like he embodied that, what they now call the incel, the involuntary celibate mentality. You know, so there's a lot of anger just because you're young male, very horny, and you're being rejected, but for whatever reason, you're awkward, you're ugly, and you're awkward. I'm going to go off on another tangent. I was recently on a panel at a comic convention, and for some reason, we were talking about doing work to appeal to young adults, and the two other creators on the panel were two young women who, they were both writers, who they wrote comics for young adults, and it was interesting to hear them talk about how, well, I guess I would say these two were in their 30s, maybe 40 at the oldest. But they still talked a lot about what they went through in their adolescence, their middle school and high school years, and feeling on the outs, not being Miss Perfect, not being the queen of the prom, being awkward, you know, being too fat, too skinny, bad skin, and how other people, mean girls, would treat you, and how boys usually would ignore you, and how it still stuck with them, that it's still what they went through, this painful from not being the queen of the prom, you know, from not being the star, you know, being a better female, how it's still, I hate to use the word scarred, but it really marked them, and they still think about it. And when they write for young adults, that's what they're always thinking about. They're always hoping they get help. Young, mainly, I'm sure they're thinking their target audience is young women, get through that. But here Grumman is demonized for talking about that same exact struggle, except that he's a boy, but it's the same exact thing. It's that same feeling of rejection, feeling like a total outcast and a loser, and nobody will ever want you, yet at the same time, you really want to attract the opposite sex, you know, or whatever sex. You want to have sex. You want to be wanted, desired, and you're experiencing the opposite. And how powerfully that affects you pretty much through the rest of your life, how much it defines you, and it's so hard to outgrow that. Like, he later became this comic book superstar and had a relatively easy time because of that, attracting women. But he still, in his gut, always felt like that ugly duckling. You know, he's still really and that's what he was with his comics. That's part of what he was trying to get across. And what I always appreciate about him, and it's a distinction that people don't acknowledge when they talk about his comics being sexist, is he's done a number of stories. There'd be like a part one, a part two. But he did a number of short comic stories called My Troubles with Women. But the important thing about that title was it said, my trouble with women. It wasn't the trouble with women. He always realized, this is my problem, and I'm doing this comic. This is me trying to hash this out. This is me trying to solve my problem. And it's about women. It's about my relationships with women, what I want from them, what they do or don't want from me. But it's him trying to sort it all out and make it work and make sense of it, whether either for the audience or thinking at least some people reading it will relate. Certainly a lot of people did. But not surprisingly, my take on Crumb and whether or not he's guilty of thought crimes. Obviously, I don't agree with his recent critics. Also, I have to say, I've noticed when I read about, like, when people were denouncing him at this recent SBX comic convention, and then how they'd respond later on in social media, I couldn't help but be amused at the way they seemed to think they invented these criticisms, that they're the first people to, it's like, were they talking about, like, what's, times have changed, and we younger people, we won't tolerate all this stuff that Robert Crumb seems to celebrate. Because the minute that I became familiar with Robert Crumb's work and all of his comics, his so-called problematic work, I was, like, in art school, and my fellow art students, half of them hated his work for the same exact reasons. So all of these arguments had been articulated for as long as he's been doing this work. There's nothing new about any of it. People have been throwing the shit at him forever. I said a swear.
You've got this trilogy of graphic biographies. And I just want to know, what led you to tackle the histories of radical women from the turn of the last century?
Well, that is a really long answer. I'll try to be concise about it. I basically had already started doing these short 1, 2, 3, 5, 8-page comic strips about historical figures, founding fathers and scientists, things like that. And I was really enjoying doing these biographical strips. And it reached the point that I both was ready, willing, and able to do a full-length biography. Around that same time, for reasons that are difficult to get into, I became very interested in they might have been activists or authors, artists, but certain creative, energetic women whose most productive period would have been between the two world wars. And what struck me, what I found very interesting about their lives, is these women did whatever they wanted to do. It almost seemed like they were more advanced mentally than women are now. They were utterly fearless. They did whatever the heck they wanted to do. And this was in the 1920s and 30s. And they were, even though if you'd asked them, they would all describe themselves as feminists. They didn't wear that term on their sleeves. They weren't self-consciously feminist. They weren't self-conscious about being female. All they were conscious of was the work they wanted to do, the work that they wanted to get done, and how to achieve that end. And as a result, they led amazing lives. Well, nobody is completely fearless. Sora Neale Hurston, for example, had her own fears and insecurities, but none of those fears and insecurities translated into keeping her from doing what she wanted to do. She was very passionate about her interests, which was anthropology, and her anthropological interests totally revolved around the African diaspora, mainly Africans who, in America, African Americans, but also in the Caribbean, and just wanted to celebrate where they were coming from. She was a very early, her and Langston Hughes were early and unapologetic advocates of the notion of black pride, mainly fighting the notion that it's lesser, that black culture is a lesser culture, basically fighting white supremacy, you know. And for a while, when she started out, you could argue that she was advocating black supremacy, that it was better. It was an understandable impulse that she had of this either-or attitude between white culture and black culture that she later realized that's a go-nowhere argument.
But mainly, you liked her attitude of just dealing with people who came up against her.
Right. And also, you know, she and her life philosophy, how she believes people should get along, how people should be left alone. Her life philosophy, which translated into politics, is identical to mine. So that was another thing, too. I was familiar with her writing first, Their Eyes Are Watching God, and also her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road. And I loved them. To this day, I can't remember how I wound up reading them. You know, if somebody suggested it, I don't know what, but I loved it. And then the more I read about her and her life, reading her biographies, the more I admired her. But yeah, I just wanted to celebrate these women who accomplished great things and also had interesting lives. It was like stuff to draw, stuff to write about. You know, I could easily do a graphic novel about an author who just wrote great stuff, like a J.D. Salinger, let's say. But, you know, most of his life, he was sitting behind a typewriter, and then the last 30 years of his life, he didn't even write and just watched TV all day. That just would make for a very boring graphic novel, you know. But these women did stuff. They were all over the world, doing all kinds of crazy crap, just getting arrested, you know.
And the other two books are Credo, which we mentioned, about Rose Wilder Lane, and Woman Rebel, about Margaret Sanger. She's credited as being the founder of Planned Parenthood. Now, she's a more problematic figure. She's hated by right-wingers for being an early supporter of birth control, and she's become radioactive on the left for flirting with eugenics.
Right. A lot of the negative stuff that leftists believe, it's either totally made up, or quotes that she didn't make but are attributed to her, or quotes that she did make that were totally taken out of context, all designed to outrage people on the left. All of these lies and distortions are from the right, from the religious right, except, unfortunately, leftists are so eager to believe the worst about people, especially if you're white, that they buy into all of it. The eugenic stuff, it's a really complicated, all that stuff, it's so hard to get into, but she was not a racist. Her association she had with the eugenics movement, which I have to tell you was mainstream, that was everybody. Everybody that went to college believed in eugenics. And also, you and I believe in eugenics because it had to do with, for example, prenatal care. Who's against prenatal care? That was part of the eugenics movement. It was just simply making a healthier next generation. Dental hygiene was part of eugenics. Just means good genes. Not everybody, even back then, thought that good genes also meant Caucasian genes or Northern European genes. And she didn't believe that. And she deliberately tried to attach the birth control movement to the eugenics movement, ironically, to give the birth control movement more legitimacy, because it was considered disgusting. She was a disgrace. A lot of doors were closed off to her. So she thought, if I made birth control part of this movement, which is all about improving future generations, which it would have, not forcing mothers to have 10 undernourished kids, that would have definitely benefited the next generation. But the leaders of the eugenics movement at the time wanted nothing to do with her. They were correct when they said, you're just trying to hitch your wagon, your gross, disgusting sex wagon, to our star. It's like, we got this great thing. It's ironic because people perceive both movements differently now. But she was the disgrace back then, and they were the golden boys. And the golden boys were literally everybody. It was presidents, U.S. presidents. Everybody at every university was all behind the eugenics movement. So it's all, when you talk about it, when you mention that word, like now, if somebody says eugenics, your thought is Nazis. You just say, oh, somebody believes in eugenics is a Nazi. And that is total bullshit. It's so ahistorical. The way people talk about eugenics, this shorthand when they say the word and the word is supposed to be an insult, it is not, it's so ahistorical. It's stupid. It's a much more complicated than that. And everybody's cutting it into the shorthand. And that's why when somebody says, well, wasn't Margaret Sanger, didn't she believe in eugenics? To a certain degree, and so did literally everybody. The only intellectuals that didn't were very devout Catholics, like Chesterton, people like that. And that was few and far between. I get crazy when I talk about Margaret Sanger because it's like the truth. I really thought with my stupid comic book that I could have stemmed this tidal wave of lies. But everybody, it's the internet. All these lies and distortions are on the internet. Everybody believes it. People are so eager to believe the worst about everybody. You hear something horrible about Margaret Sanger, whether you're on the right or the left, you automatically believe it because you read it on the internet. You find it hard to believe that somebody could have simply made it up, but it's all either fiction or distortions, and it's like I'm fighting this incredible losing battle when it comes to her, and I feel like I'm fighting it by myself, you know? Oh, Margaret Sanger, Mrs. Abortion, the inventor of abortion, and people might even say that sarcastically, but it's like, she was against abortion. How many times do I have to say that? But everybody thinks she's the abortion queen, you know?
Well, so what's next for you? Got any dream projects coming up?
It's very torturous. I still every day think I won't do it, but the next project, if anything, would be a memoir about my late brother. I had an older brother, Doug, who, when we were young, he was a cartoonist and very naturally gifted, a very funny cartoonist, and he was a big inspiration of mine. But his life took a fairly tragic turn. So it's very personal. It's something he died like 23 years ago. And ever since then, I've wanted to do a memoir about him. It basically would be about my relationship with him. It'd be about the two of us. But some of my family members are not too crazy about this idea. So I don't know. I might not do it. We'll see. But I'm still doing lots of stuff for Reason Magazine, things like that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been illustrator, editor, and comics artist, Peter Bagg. Pete, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. This was great.
And many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archive version of the show, along with extended versions, later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, @wordsandpicture.